Welcome to our newest adventure for first responder wellness. No one fights alone. In-depth conversations about mental health and culture in the first responder space. We're joined by your co-hosts, Austin Pedersen and Brad Shepard.
Back with the No One Fights Alone podcast. I am super excited about this guest. I have followed this guest for quite some time with his artwork, Dan Sundahl. Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
I am infamous for getting on here and messing up people's last names. Dan Sundahl, the artist, and we'll get into your art in a little bit because the way you capture the moment and the full gravity of really just some amazing things and the heart and texture of what's going on with the first responder is amazing. But I want to jump into your bio, Dan. But welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. I know our listeners are going to be excited about this. I've already talked to a few of them that follow you as well. Dan Sundahl, a published artist and writer for art books, books produced of his works, articles of his work are featured in several international publications. Art is recognized and exhibited worldwide. Daniel's a counseling therapist, advanced care paramedic, and retired career firefighter. He's the president and founder of the Recovery and Resiliency Foundation, a charitable organization that helps support people living with symptoms of trauma. Daniel, born in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, taking up global residency as an English language teacher in Egypt, Mexico, Indonesia, and Japan. I want to ask you about that. That sounds fascinating, by the way. He now works full-time as an artist, counselor, and public speaker. The majority of Daniel's works involves emergency services imagery, which is why I'm having you on today, because of this incredible art, and comprises an emotional connection to the artist, as most of his pieces are based on actual emergency calls he has attended as a paramedic and firefighter. He's passionate about reducing the stigma of PTSD for first responders, and uses his art to raise awareness of occupational stress injuries worldwide. As a counselor, Daniel specializes in trauma, interpersonal relationship issues, and substance abuse and addiction. He also has specialized training in utilizing ketogenic diets for metabolic and mental health. I love that. I hope we have some time to spend on that as well. First responders' mental wellness initiatives were initiated after visiting his peers in Australia, Finland, and Mississippi. Daniel often travels and gains inspiration for his art from his experiences. Learn more about Daniel and his artwork by visiting his webpage at www.dansunphotos.com. And we're going to finish with that. I definitely want to give all of our listeners at the end an opportunity to find you, not just with your website, but if you have social media or LinkedIn or any social media pages that you want to offer up at the end, I'll circle back to that as well. But welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast, Dan. Thanks for coming on here.
Great. Thanks, Brian. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, all the way from Canada, I'm assuming you're in Edmonton currently. Is that correct?
I am. That's right. Well, a small town just west of Edmonton.
Okay.
Called Spruce Grove.
Is it cold up there yet?
Yes. Yeah, we had a bit of a storm this morning, but not as cold as it has been the last few years. So far, this winter's been pretty good. Sometimes in February, we get hit with some pretty nasty weather, but I like it up here. It's nice.
Well, before we get into some of the more meaty portions of our conversation, I'm fascinated by this English teacher journey that you were on for a while. That sounds fascinating. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, Brad, it's actually about a girl.
Oh, of course it is.
Yeah, of course it is, right? So I was in school. I had just finished my EMT. Now we call it in Canada, we call it a primary care paramedic. And I met this girl who wanted to go traveling. And she got this idea in my head about, we can go become English language teachers. We can go to Egypt, go to school, learn how to do it through this course from Cambridge University. It's a pretty intensive course, pretty heavy duty. And then we can travel the world and teach English. And I'm like, sure. So that's what we did.
If it's with you, so honey, I want to go anywhere.
Right? So, and it was, what an amazing experience that was. I'm so happy that I met her. And we're not together anymore, but we're still friends. And yeah, it was amazing. We were in Egypt, went to school there and taught English there. Then went to Jakarta and lived in Jakarta for a year or two. And then moved to Mexico and taught English there. So yeah, it was it was a wonderful time of my life. And then I decided, I think it was in the early 2000s, that I should probably get a real job. Right. Not that teaching English wasn't a real job. Like, don't get me wrong. Sure. Part of me now wishes I had stuck with it, but because it was such an amazing experience. But then I decided to come back home and then become an advanced care paramedic, and then worked full time from 2003 until 2023, well, 2022, I guess.
That is, yeah, that is awesome. So your travels of teaching English, I find that fascinating. The amount of people that you would meet and interact with, and probably the relationships you would develop from that. What would be like an aha moment revelation? That were there any things revealed to you that you like, I didn't see that coming? Like, I didn't realize the impact that this was, yeah, would have on my life.
You know what I loved about it was, and I always traveled a lot before that, and I still travel now as a tourist, but traveling that way and living in different cultures is a little bit different, right? And because we were teaching English, we were meeting a lot of people. Sure. And a lot of the other teachers that were in the school were from other countries. And so, yeah, it was great. It was really eye-opening, yeah, to see how other cultures live and to really get immersed in it and really experience it. It was really shaped who I am, and it had a profound effect on my life forever. And that was over 20, 25 years ago, I guess now. But yeah, that really shaped who I am. And I think in that, a large part, the communication that I had to have with my students and people with, didn't even speak English, or other teachers in that area, really helped me in my career as a paramedic firefighter. I really learned some of valuable skills on interpersonal communication and how to relate to people. And I found it really, really helpful.
I've found that in communities where they don't really expand or see, and this is not a negative, it's as I'm formulated in my mind talking about it, it sounds like it may come out somewhat negative, but I've found that the more I travel, the more curious I am about people, because you see, most times you just see on a superficial level. I'll give you an example. People used to say, before I went to New York, people would say New York people are mean and angry all the time. And when I went to New York, I had really lived life a little bit, and I came back and I said, I don't find them mean and angry. I find them that I'm irrelevant. A lot. I mean, they just don't care that you're in their space one way or the other, you know. And yeah, and if you are in their way, they're going to yell at you and just go on. It's not like they don't dislike you. They just and mm-hmm. really, I say that to say that it this curiosity about humanity that oftentimes I think we would be well served to spend a little bit more time of looking and understanding people, which is why I find that your journeys, they're fascinating. Our owner of Chateau, yeah, Danny Warner, he gets to talking about stories of his travel. He's well traveled across the globe, and I just find it fascinating, some of his stories and interactions.
I think it's really, I used to live in Japan as well, and you know, living in Japan as a stocky Scandinavian Canadian guy, you know, I really kind of stuck out there. But it really taught me a lot. Super friendly people, really fast. I loved it. I almost never left Japan. I loved it.
I've heard many people say that they absolutely,
oh, it's an incredible culture, and the people are amazing. But I think traveling and living in lots of different cultures really enhanced my ability to be a pluralistic thinking, meaning that I can see perspectives of other people. I'm open to seeing how other people view and see things. Mm-hmm. And that, which again, helped me as a first responder and as a counselor now, I think has been a really valuable skill that I've developed because of traveling and experiencing other cultures that way.
Of course. No, it really is fascinating. Well, let's dive a little bit into your career. So from teaching and traveling, you decided to become a first responder, get rich quick scheme of
yeah, of course, becoming a paramedic. Yeah, we're all in it for the money,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for the sure. money. Yeah. So at what age were you starting then?
I was a late bloomer, so I didn't graduate as a as a advanced care paramedic, where I got the full-time job till I was 35. So I became an EMT in 1993, and then I traveled a bunch. Didn't actually work as an EMT. Traveled right after that. I traveled, met that girl, changed my life. And 35 is when I became a full-time paramedic firefighter.
Well, I feel like as we converse, I want to talk about the art, and I feel like some of your career may drift into the conversation as we talk to your art. So let me just kind of introduce the art for our listeners. I would really encourage you to go to Dan's website, DanSunPhotos.com. Is that right?
That's right.
DanSunPhotos.com. And I'm just going to kind of kick that door in open first, because I feel like that may permeate its way back into some of your career, just based upon, your bio said a lot of your artwork is, scenes and stories that are unfolding in your art. And to be my personal opinion of your art, when I was, shout out to Ben. Ben's not able to make it on today. He had an emergency. He had to leave off. But I was describing this to Ben. I was so excited about this. I can't wait for Dan to get on, because he was asking me a little bit about my impression. I said his art is dark. I said, but it's not dark in the way of what you would think. It's just these images that I would think about, these scenes that you walk away and think, that one was rough. That one was tough. That one's going to stay with me for a while. That one, and when you're in that moment, you don't necessarily think about it, but when all the dust settles and you're sitting here, and many of these pieces of art, Dan, are so moving, so touching, to me personally, but people that I've talked to have said he captured the essence of that pain or that hurt or that loss. Is that accurate on some of your feedback from people?
Yeah. So a lot of people don't like my artwork. They think it is too dark. Mm-hmm. They think it's too depressing, but the artwork is actually a byproduct of my therapy.
Of course.
So as I was diagnosed with PTSD in 2014, and what my psychologist did at the time is he knew that I was into photography. I was taking pictures of my dogs and landscapes and stuff. And I understand what he was doing now that I'm a therapist myself, but he was trying to integrate a creative part of my brain as a way to process for American friends, what was happening in my mind so I could put it away. And I do the same thing with my clients. I try to find a creative aspect or another part of the brain where they can work through the emotions or feelings or concepts that they're struggling with that don't seem to leave their mind. That I call them, for me, I describe it as a monster that invaded my consciousness uninvited. It would just pop into my head.
Very unwelcome.
Very unwelcome. Mm-hmm. But when I created the artwork, then that no longer happened. So when I create the artwork, it has to be very authentic to me and my experience in order for it to be therapeutic. So I don't censor it. I don't think, are people going to like this? Because if I did, then it's not going to be therapeutic for me. And I still create artwork that way, where I have this concept or this idea that's stuck in my head and I need to get it out. And I can't censor it. But the funny thing is, by doing that, by creating it for myself and being authentic to who I am, I actually connect more with my peers. If I started creating artwork for people that thinking, okay, well, what would people like? Say I had an experience, I'm like, okay, well, this is how I perceive it, but I'm going to try to create something how I think other people will perceive it and see what people would like. And then maybe they'll buy it, right? If I started doing that, then my peers would see right through it, right? They would see that it wasn't authentic. So for me, in order for it to be real, I need to be vulnerable in creating it. And when I'm done, it's like I trap this monster that invades my consciousness uninvited into this two-dimensional picture. because I spend so much time thinking about what I'm doing is while I'm creating it, I'm thinking about the emotion. I'm thinking about the experience. I'm trying to recreate how I feel versus what I saw and what neurobiologically I'm processing is what I'm doing.
Of course.
But I'm doing it in a, and I'm feeling, it's pretty emotional, but I'm getting it out. I'm putting it away. So it's done. And now it doesn't pop into my head anymore after when I'm finished. And for the longest time, I never even shared my artwork with anybody. I thought it would be totally unaccepted. So I didn't share it for a long time.
It wasn't even too impactful or stir up too much or just
First one, I thought that people, because the very first image that I did, it was this paramedic. It's kind of a two-parter, two paramedics working on a guy in the back of the ambulance. They're doing CPR. There's his spirit slipping out of his body. And then the second picture is that he's dead. The spirit of the patient is sitting in the airway seat and the paramedic is sitting there with his gloved hands on his head. Right. Which for me kind of made me feel, and that's, there's a whole story based on that image. And when I was done, it made me feel great. But if I thought at the time, and this is, well, 10 years ago, over 10 years ago now, when I created that one, I'm like, I'm not going to share this with anybody. Like, what are my peers going to think if I show artwork of a paramedic firefighter, you know, being vulnerable, being emotional with gloved hands on their face? That's disgusting.
Right.
I'm like, oh, I'm going to get crucified. So I didn't share with anybody, but it was very therapeutic for me. So when I was done, I'm like, oh, I feel so much better. But I'm like, I'm not going to share this with anybody. Eventually I did, just because I kind of looks cartoony and I think it's a cool looking image. Totally expecting that I was going to get totally crucified. But the exact opposite happened. So many of my peers really looked at it and really connected, attaching their own experiences to that image. And it really struck a pretty, pretty deep nerve.
Well, I'm pretty sure I recall the art piece that you're referring to, and his hands in his head just say so much about those of us that have been there. I mean, they just tell such an incredible story of, you know, any number of things that could be running through his brain of failure. I did all I could. What's going to happen next? I have to go talk to the family. You know, what it just could be so many different things from so many different perspectives.
And the patient's spirit is in the airway seat.
Right.
And he's like, he has this judgmental look as he's looking at the paramedic. So
you cost
there's
me
a reason that.
Yeah. You cost me my life.
And it actually wasn't even that. So it really wasn't even the patient. It was actually about the patient's mother. So as he died, this is based on a real call, and it happened pretty early on in my career. So as this kid died, he was hit by a drunk driver. He reverted into a child. So he was calling for his mommy as he died. And that's what really stuck with me. As, you know, this woman's going to receive the worst news of her life. Right. It's, and how her life was going to change is really what stuck with me and affected me. And so the idea of that image isn't so much that I failed him, I failed his mom, but he would have, like, he had injuries incompatible with life, but he was conscious and talking, and his injuries were just too much. We didn't get him to the hospital.
Right.
Who knows even if we got him to the hospital in time, if he would have survived, but that's what stuck with me. And I don't usually like to tell people the stories behind the images, because when people look at it, they attach their own experience. Right. And if they hear what mine is, some people may devalue their interpretation of it, but it's not any less accurate. If you look at it and it reminds you of a certain call that you did, or reminds you of an emotion that you did, then that is just as valuable, which is why I love artwork. Right? People will look at artwork and if it evokes an emotional response, then I think that's good artwork.
I think that's fascinating that you say that. I actually had wondered that if at any point you tell the backstory, it then transfers from their story and their interpretation to your story, and it becomes less impactful, if not less helpful. I think I have to say, some of the things in this artwork are, for me, as I'm sitting here, I'm scrolling through it, and I'm on your law enforcement side now because that's my discipline that I choose. I just switched over to the EMS, but this several of your pieces are this internal evil struggle, and this my interpretation, this whether it's internal or external, most of your pieces of art that I see identify with that are, my interpretation, or it's an external struggle of evil versus good that is trying to take something from me, if not take me, you know, as a whole, as a being. Oftentimes, you know, maybe even the conversation of suicide. There's one where evil's pulling him, and you know, his arms are out, and his family has the other. I'm going from memory here because I don't have it pulled up.
Yeah. But
where his family, that's my interpretation. His family is pulling him on one side, and this evil is pulling from the other way. I just find it incredible how you have connected with so many different facets of our occupation as first responders. Not just, and because I hear you saying you're paramedic and firefighter, but you've permeated into several other disciplines within the ER, within law enforcement, wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And I think when people look at the artwork, it's really based on their own experiences. I was quite worried that my artwork would trigger people. So I had some conversations with some psychologists. I'm like, hey, should I not share this? Because that's not why I create it for myself. It's part of my therapy. And because I get some negative feedback from the artwork. And the two psychologists that I spoke with, they said, Dan, when that happens, it's less about the artwork and more about what they're bringing to the artwork. Mm. Essentially, what you're doing is you're forcing them to look at themselves.
Right.
And it's actually a healthy thing for them to do. So they both encouraged me to keep sharing the artwork and to continue being authentic. I do use angels and demons in a lot of my artwork. And then people interpret that their own way.
Right.
Some people don't like that. But I use devils to represent trauma and angels to represent recovery. So in my artwork, but other people will look at it like yourself and see it in a different way, right? So which is totally okay. Your interpretation of my artwork isn't more valid or authentic than my interpretation in making it. This doesn't, because I created it, doesn't make it more valuable. And it's just easier for me. So for me, as a first responder, I really found how trauma entered my mind, not in a way that I thought PTSD worked, where I had that one call and then after that one call, I'm different. It was very gradual. I didn't really recognize that it was happening until I became suicidal. So it's very insidious, I find, that it was kind of snuck up on me and, you know, tried to...
Sure.
convince me to take my life. And so I find, yeah, that's a shit thing to do, right? Right. That's not very nice. And I understand that I understand the biology of how that happens over time and building new neural pathways and pruning over old ones. And I get that, but for me to understand it and process it and create the artwork, I think for me, the imagery of devils to represent trauma and angels to represent recovery is a good way for me to get that out of my head, these complex ideas out of my head.
Thank you for that. There is just so many pieces that I find fascinating. I want to kind of go back to the beginning of this little segment that we were talking about as your first piece. I think you described how you wanted to make sure that was connected to peers draw your art or create your art. It's interesting that you did not want it to be influenced or by other people's, how did you put it? You don't want to be influenced by how it may impact somebody else or censored. I think you used the word censored.
Yeah.
Why is that important? Why was that important to you, to the process of
this? Well, I think that's important for any artist creating, being creative.
Right.
Is to, because if I started creating artwork for other people, which don't get me wrong, I do a lot of commission work. So I try to get try to recreate what they're going through. But when I do the artwork for my therapy, for myself, then I have to be authentic in order for the therapeutic process to happen. So in order for me to truly process it, I can't deny things. I can't think, okay, well, and it happens often. I'm like, oh, I don't know if I should do this one. Probably my favorite art piece is called The Demon Eats the Ambulance Driver. Man, I got a lot of crap for that, for saying ambulance driver. But that was purposeful. I called it ambulance driver on purpose. And it's probably the darkest image that I have. Someone pointed out to me that the abbreviation of that is dead. I'm like, oh, I didn't even realize that. But it's this paramedic who's being held by this big demon, and the demon is eating his head. Like, it's pretty dark, pretty messed up. But for me, that image represents the act of suicide. It's pretty dark, pretty deep.
I'm looking for it now. I'm trying to look at, as we're speaking about it, I'm trying to find it.
Yeah, if you just Google Demon Eats the Ambulance Driver dance on it, should pop up.
Okay.
But it's, and when I finished it, for me, it was very therapeutic. And the idea of that is that the paramedic isn't fighting back. He's not, his arms are down. He's not trying to fight for his life. He is allowing himself to be consumed by his trauma. And for me, that represented the actual act of suicide. Pretty heavy, pretty deep. But when I was done that image, I cried, because it was such a authentic visual representation of this complex feeling and emotion that I had. And when I thought, oh man, am I going to share it? Like, people are going to think this is messed up. People are going to think, what is wrong with this guy if I share this one? But I'm like, no, I told myself that I have to be authentic. And part of being authentic to who I am is sharing the artwork, which makes me vulnerable. And there's a lot of healing in being vulnerable for me. And a lot of other people really connected with it that were in that state of mind. So when I create the images and I share them, I don't share the specific call or event that it's related to. I share the concept or my motivation, my general concept or idea of why I created it, not the specific event or something.
Sure.
Yeah, that one. Funny thing is, the more real and authentic
it is.
Yeah,
it
right.
It is heavy.
It's pretty heavy.
Yes, very heavy. I when I go back to talking, you know, to Ben and saying I describe this as very dark, I don't say that with any kind of negative at all. In fact, I followed that with him. I said it is absolutely amazing artwork, and I like how you described that, because it's a better way of unpacking this interpretation of the other side, whether you call it trauma or what I called it was evil, or because so many of us in this community of first responders and veterans have seen that other side, if not gone over there and existed for a while in trauma, evil, so whatever, you know, suicide thinking, thoughts, whatever. And I just find it fascinating how you put that into color. And
yeah, thanks. Thank you. That means a lot to me, because it's so personal to me. When I hear fellow first responders connect to my artwork, like, I genuinely, that means a lot, because it's it's very personal to me when I create the images. This is my brain. This is my mind. This is what I'm thinking. So when others connect to it, then that really validates and really makes me feel like I'm not alone. Like, I'm not fighting alone, right? Because there's a community there, which I didn't really understand was there. There's a lot of shame that happens with PTSD that people have. which isolates them. So when I did this artwork and so many people connected to it, it was really helpful for me. It was wonderful.
So again, I'm going to go back to, I find this beginning fascinating. So if I go back to the beginning again, I'm going to circle us back there again, just for a minute, mm-hmm. Your first piece, I know you unpacked that for us a little bit, but your first piece like that, if, and I'm more thinking, maybe asking the question based upon what if this would be helpful to somebody else or somebody out here who's listening to say, maybe I should try to do something like this. Where did you start? Did you have guidance? Did you ask somebody, or did you, I know you said your therapist had encouraged you to do this, but, did you just pick a pencil up and a coloring book and say a blank slate and say, I'm going to try this? Or did you maybe have some direction? Did you do some research on it? Did you have an artist that you consulted with?
I was doing artwork before as kind of a hobby, okay. which most people have. And my psychologist said, hey, why don't you try creating the artwork based on these feelings you're having? I thought it was a horrible idea. Mm-hmm. I'm like, that is dumb. Like, why do I want to think about this stuff? Mm-hmm. I'm like, I came here, give me a pill so I feel better and go back to work. And he's like, yeah, Dan, it doesn't work that way.
It's like, you give really me a Band-Aid and get stuff. Me back in the game. Yeah. That's all right? I'm asking of you.
And he said, no, Dan, it does. You got to step into this stuff. You got to step into it, work through it, and then get it out. That's how it works. I'm like, oh, that sucks. Yeah. He goes, yeah, it's hard work, but try it. And he was right. So all my artwork is actually photo-based. So all the images are staged. I photograph them and then I digitally draw and paint on top of the photograph. And if I was trying to get I did take some courses on how to use my camera, mm-hmm. but I haven't taken any art classes or art courses. And if I needed to, okay, well, how am I going to ghost in, or how am I going to put a devil, or how am I going to put an angel? I just kind of YouTube university'd it, mm-hmm. right? It's great that anything that you can, like, how do I do this in Photoshop? And to the point where I developed my own style, which is recognizable by a lot of people.
Right.
And the real therapy from that is that I'm accessing the creative part of my mind while I'm processing the trauma that I had. That's the real benefit. I also play guitar, but I'm not good. Mm-hmm. So I don't get invited to podcasts, play my guitar, or travel the world and play my guitar.
Dan, I would give you that space. If you feel like you need to get on here,
nobody wants to hear it.
I would let we can bring him on.
Yeah, nobody wants to hear it. But the point is playing music for me is also very therapeutic. So I'm just super lucky, because it really has changed my life, that the artwork that I create has been so widely accepted from so many of my peers around the world, which has now given me the opportunity to travel. I speak with thousands of our peers, and it's really changed my life, which is fantastic. But the real... that's beside the point of the therapeutic process of doing the work, right? So with my clients now, I find out, you know, what kind of hobbies do you have? You know, how can we incorporate new neural pathways while you're thinking about the traumatic experiences in a different way that your brain is wired to do, so that we can build new pathways and you can associate it in a different, more positive way, so you don't have the emotional response that you get when you think of those calls or those events or scenes that you've been on.
I'm really glad you brought that up. I if you don't mind, I'm going to tee this question up with a preemptive question, but I'm going to tee this up for you. If you don't mind, I would love to hear more about how you see that working and unpacking in the neuro on how the mind and body is helped by this creative, engaging this creative side. And if you don't mind, we'll go into that in just a little bit, but this, mm-hmm. this, to tee that up a little bit, your creative, freedom, we'll go back to this kind of this censorship piece. Your creative freedom was put it on paper. Don't let anything else influence it. Make sure that it is your feeling down on paper, because why? What, like, fill in the blank. It's really important that it's not hindered by something external or how it's going to make somebody else feel. because it's that important. Because why? Feel that what was the what's
well,
the
it has that one? It has to be authentic, right? It has to be authentic. So if I use the analogy of your desk, right, and the traumatic experiences that you have or relive is another piece of paper on your desk. So you've gone from not wanting to sit at your desk because there's so many pieces of paper on it to not even wanting to walk by your office, to not even wanting to be in the house because you know that desk is there and you know that it's just piles and piles of paper. Mm-hmm. But what you have to do is go into that office, sit at that desk, pick up each piece of paper, read it, and put it in the filing cabinet. So if you're not being authentic, you think, okay, well, what are other people going to think? That's like taking that piece of paper that's on your desk and just putting it on another area of your desk. It's not getting off the desk. It's still going to be there because you're not really going to be able to put it away. And with many of my clients, we do, if it's right for them, if they feel it's good, is we do a lot of journaling or when it comes to moral injury, sacred text where you write the people that you feel you harm, which is really prominent in law enforcement, where you write the, and it has to be authentic. So if you're writing a letter to, you know, maybe I do a lot of couples work as well, to a person that, you know, you're trying to get over, then you need to be, you need to let it out. And sometimes my clients will give me the letters and they're really nice and polite. I'm like, no, I'm like, let it rip, like really open up and really be authentic in how you're feeling. You're not going to send it to them, but it's important for you to feel the emotion, feel it, feel the emotion and let it. And that's like going to your desk, looking at the piece of paper, reading it, comprehending it, and then deciding, okay, where in the filing cabinet is this going to go? You walk to the filing cabinet and you put it away, and then it's not on the desk anymore. And we have to do that with every piece of paper. Some of those pieces of paper on the desk has been there since you were a child, and those are usually the biggest and heaviest ones, and the thickest ones, and those sometimes take a little bit of work to get through, but that's what
bottom
has to be
of the
done.
Pile, I don't want to deal with that. Yeah, I yeah, see, but it's not, I see how the metaphor, yeah, I see your metaphor, and I personally journal, and the reason I'm asking kind of this line of thought with the question is I talk to a lot of people about journaling because it helped me, and I mean, it's not for everybody, but it is a way of taking a creative execution of something creative, engaging that and putting it on paper. And oftentimes when I tell people, there's a couple of my journal entries where they are dark. They're a lot of fuck yous on the page, you know, there's been days, and I've still got some of those journals from time to time. I pull them out and just, it's a good reminder of where I've been.
And don't hold back.
Right.
There's another part of the journaling. Well, with not so much with the journaling, but if you're doing with the moral injury where you're writing the letter to somebody or a person or an organization that you feel they've betrayed you, or in some way you've betrayed yourself, which is where the moral injury comes from, is you write the letter, you really bring it all out, and then you have some type of ceremonial process. Right. So you either burn the page, right, or with often a military, you write the letter of that person that you shot or killed. You actually go back, we'll go back to the location and put that piece of paper under a rock at that exact location. Right. Super therapeutic, cathartic for that to happen. Right. So it has to be authentic. Right. So when you go back, going back to your original question, if you censor yourself thinking, okay, what are people going to think? Then you don't get the therapeutic process of it. And people always tell me, oh, Dan, I wish I was creative. I can't draw a stick man. Like, it doesn't matter if you're good or not. That's beside the point. Like, the real benefit of it is being authentically creative, not thinking or guessing what are other people going to think of this, right? Because then that's going to hinder that.
Do you feel like that's part of the shame piece that pervades in as well, this judgment, this feeling that we're being judged or interpreted poorly?
You know where I think that comes in is people, they may be hesitant to be true to themselves for shaming themselves, mm-hmm. not so much mm-hmm. other people. Because by putting words or images or using tactile, like using your hand while you're thinking of it and expressing it in a different way, makes it more real, which is part of the healing part, which may intensify the shame part, even if you don't share with somebody. But then it's kind of forcing, putting that mirror up to your face. And you're like, yeah, this sucks, but this is it. This is reality. This is, what are we going to do about it? But I think the shame component might be less about sharing with other people and really being authentic with yourself, which is super helpful. Like, that's what I think we should do.
Well, I find that, again, I find this whole conversation fascinating, but my time at Chateau, one of the most revealing aspects of that for me was exactly what you're talking about, what you just described, which was this betrayal. I'll use the word self-betrayal. Mm-hmm. Whereas I had arrived to this realizing in so many different facets of my life, I had betrayed myself. So it wasn't so much people pleasing, which is what I was doing, but I was ignoring, if not, unconsciously, but sometimes even consciously, betraying what I believed in or my own values or my own beliefs. Mm-hmm. I carried a lot of inward, you know. That's when you, I feel like for me personally, and what I've seen in others now since then is that's where people, they no longer are looking in the mirror the same. They're, the person they see in the mirror is not who they want to be or not who they had hoped they would be. Is that hitting close with what we're talking
totally.
About?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And unfortunately, some people feel trapped, right? Where they're in a job that they don't love anymore. They don't, you know, when we're not living true to our values and we feel like we're handcuffed in the positions that we're in. It's like driving a 8-cylinder car where only 6 of the mm-hmm. cylinders are working, right? It goes forward, but the gas mileage is shitty,
right?
You're burning oil. It's not running right. And then eventually it doesn't break down. So it feels, I did this art piece called Skewed, where it's this paramedic and I shifted his whole body. So his face, it's not symmetrical. It's like a little bit off, mm-hmm. right? When the write up was about this idea of you're being skewed and just not living true to yourself. And I understand it's hard, but when you have a mortgage and you have a family, and you know that the job that you have is not healthy for you mentally, but you need to pay the bills. That is a tough spot to be in, right? But what's the result going to be? Like how? And often I'll ask my clients, okay, if nothing changes, what do you think is going to happen? And almost every single one of them knows. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, this is going to end in badness. I'm like, yeah. So let's not wait till badness happens. Let's try to come up with some solutions or something that we can do. But I do a lot of work with core value work because our core values really determine, you know, what we believe and what our decisions are and our behaviors. So I do a lot of, I've developed my own, called an emotional diagnostic tool that I do with my clients. They can recognize when they're feeling bad about something or they're struggling with something, they can tie it back to one of the core values. So I have them put it on their phone. On my phone, I have my 10 core values on my phone. Mm-hmm. So if I feel bad about something, I'm like, okay, I feel bad. Mm-hmm. Which one of my core mm-hmm. values is being challenged? I recognize it. Then I also have them do an action word to the core value to internally validate it. Like, okay, this is my core value and this is why. And that's, they've already determined what that was. And so that they're able to take kind of the power back from other people that may be challenging their core values. And then we go through a radical acceptance theory where it's like, okay, well, one, what are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. Can you change it? No. Okay. Two, is there a way that you can reframe it? Can we change our perspective to see how we can see this in a different way? Can we spin it in a certain way? Three, should we leave the situation? Should you quit that job? Should you leave that relationship? Or four, which is what most people do, is do nothing and suffer. Those are pretty much the four options we have. So it's a tool that I give my clients that
they're really simple.
Well, it simplifies it, but it's not simple.
Well, it's well, I feel right. Like it's simple in theory. The execution of it is what is enormously difficult. The execution is tough. I mean, those are those courageous little steps that we talk about all the time. Sometimes courageous big steps, but I find that a lot of this really does come down to simple conversations or simple decisions. The execution of them are hard.
Yes. And I think people that have been suffering from trauma, especially for a long time, and the way their neurology has been affected, they may lose capacity to do things that other people may think is completely normal. Like even filling out paperwork or filling out, okay, well, here's an incident report. You got to fill it out. That could be really difficult. So to bring up ideas or concepts that are very complex in the therapy realm, sometimes it's just too much. It's overwhelming, which is why I use this tool. It kind of puts it into a framework, at least, where, okay, well, which one of these four steps do you want to work on? And it's a bit easier to digest when you're in that trauma brain where you're finding things difficult to process. So it simplifies it in that way. Simplifies it to work with it in a less confusing way, I think.
I absolutely love this. So I do want to circle back to the creative neuropathway piece. And I would love to hear now, I'm going to make a leap here. You didn't necessarily know, because now you went back to school. If memory serves me correctly, in the early part of this conversation, you went back to school to become a therapist. When you were probably in the therapist's office, you didn't know the neuro.
No, I thought it was a horrible
the
idea.
Biology of it all. But now I would love to have your perspective, because it may be helpful to some of our listeners of why is this helpful? Why does this work the way it does?
Yeah. So how the brain works in trauma. And again, I'm not a neurologist, but I've read many, 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 many books and studied a lot of separate courses. I actually am a certified clinical trauma specialist. So take an extra education in that. But with trauma, and I recognize it for myself, as I was going through school, I spent 2.5 years psychoanalyzing myself. Like, oh, that's what happened. That's why.
And you paid to have, you paid to do that.
Right. I paid to do it. I'm like, oh, this is like 2 years of self-therapy. It was wonderful. But normally, what often happens with trauma is that we have this trauma loop in our brain that when we think of something or something triggers us, our brain doesn't know that we're in a safe place or it isn't happening right now. Or it doesn't know, it doesn't have a time frame. So it sends off the hormones for us to have the emotional response as if it was happening over and over. And every time we have that happening, part of this called the HPA axis, that neural pathway gets deeper and more ingrained. It's like going through a forest. The first time you go through the forest, it's pretty tough. But the more you go through a forest and you build a pathway, and then the more you walk through that pathway, then eventually that pathway through the forest turns into like a 12-lane superhighway. So it's really easy for those neural pathways to go that way. But when we use, and it's all automatic, it happens automatically in our brain, as it should. The reason it happens automatically so that we don't have to think about reacting to trauma. So when that bear comes out of the forest and starts to attack you, you don't have to sit there and think, oh, okay, this is dangerous. This is what it happens automatically, right? And that's how the brain's supposed to be. But when we have those deep ingrained traumatic neural pathways that have developed that are affecting us in so many ways where we don't even know when it's going to come, now a smell reminds us, or, you know, we see a color, it reminds us, or we watch a TV show and it reminds us, our brain goes back to that exact same spot and it's another path through that forest, making it wider and wider. It happens all automatically. But using creativity or exposure therapy, we start to activate our frontal lobe, the executive function of our brain. If you think of breathing, right, we breathe automatically. We don't have to think about it, but we can think about it. We can activate our frontal cortex and be like, okay, I'm going to concentrate on my breathing. I'm going to think about it. So when I create my artwork, I'm accessing those memories. But instead of this automatic thing happening, which happened for years, I'm now controlling all that happens. I'm feeling the emotion, but I'm also integrating my frontal cortex in the creative part of my brain while it's happening. So I'm actually creating new neural pathways while I do it. Right? New neural pathways that when they get triggered or when they get developed, they're not sending the signals to my amygdala for me to have the emotional and physical response to it. So I'm able to put that memory in a different part of my brain so that I can recall that scene or that event without being emotional about it. So that kind of, it super oversimplifies it, but
no, but the,
it works.
It is part of what we talk about often on here, which is creating these new neural pathways. And there's a variety of things that we introduce in these conversations about how to do that. And we're talking about this creative spirit today. And with your art, you're creating a way to let that go, as it were. I know that's oversimplifying, mm-hmm. but that's...
Yeah, I'm not letting it go. I'm putting the memory in a different spot on my brain, right, so that it's not automatically activated. Right. So my brain now knows, okay, when I think of this call, I picture the image. I've attached the image to that call. Whereas before it was just this organic thing that just happened whenever I wanted to. I've trapped it into this thing. So now I associate that memory with that image. So now I can choose when to recall that image instead of that event just popping into my brain, whatever it wants.
I absolutely love this. If I circle us back, and I'm going to kind of wrap us up here a little bit, but I want to circle us back to the art as we finish up. And I want to get your, offer you up the opportunity to kind of do your own wrap up of sorts. But I want to introduce the question of, I feel like, I'm going to make a broad generalization here in a form of a question. I feel like this art has an opportunity to open up a conversation that people would not normally have, maybe within their personal interpersonal relationships or even their intimate relationships or even with their therapist. I feel like this art says, that's me. And a person can say, "Ooh, wow, tell me how that's you." And mm-hmm. Am I missing it here? Am I closer or far away?
Yeah, that happens a lot. So I've just published my fourth art book. So every couple of years I create enough images to create a new art book. And they're big coffee table art books, and their color is proper and it's big photo paper. And the main reason I do it, to be honest, I don't sell a lot of them. I don't make a lot of money on them. But the idea is, when I'm 95 years old and I can't remember who I am, I'll have this stack of books. Look at all this. This is my work. But what people that have,
guy named Dan something.
Yeah, who's this weird guy making all this artwork? God, why do I have these books? But the great thing with the books is that some departments will have them like in their mess halls, right? Mm-hmm. Or a lot of counselors or therapists will have them as a kind of a conduit to open up the conversation, mm-hmm. of okay, well, let's talk about this. Go through this book. Do any of these images mm-hmm. resonate with you? And if they do, tell me why. What do you see in this image? And a lot of people will ask me, "Hey, Dan, I saw your latest art piece. And I want to ask, did you put this in here? Because that's what I see." And often I didn't. Mm-hmm. But I tell them, and I'm not going to tell them I didn't, but I'll say, "Hey, if you see that there, then it's there." Right? So when people look through the images and they relate to it in their own way, that's really a way for them to, and people will get emotional when they see it, but in the setting, in the therapeutic setting, that's kind of where the magic happens. It's really accessing those emotions and feeling them. I love the term where it's trauma plus the unwillingness to face trauma is where pain happens. So it's not the trauma itself that's the issue. It's how we process it and what we do with it. Whereas trauma plus the willingness to step into that trauma is where the growth happens. Mm-hmm. So to really step into that and process those feelings is really in a safe environment. That's really where some really fantastic.
Well, it's certainly been said that, you know, pain is the touchstone of growth, and it has to be alongside that willingness, because I have seen people exist in pain for years. So there has to be at some point. Well, I have talked with enough people. I love the way you unpacked that, because I have talked with enough people about the art, is that I've actually seen and heard people talk about your art enough that they see something that I didn't see. So the way you're describing it is I find it fascinating, because I have experienced that on just a small level of, oh, I didn't see that. Or you're seeing this in a different way than I'm seeing it. And I just find your art fascinating, Dan. I really think you are such a blessing to our community. And for those of you who have not seen Dan's art, you need to run to his website and take a look. If for no other reason than just to exist in it for a little bit. And, you know, my personal opinion, there's some of those pieces that they're pretty amazing. And in my own career, amazing being a very gentle word to that. But for those listeners out there that have not seen Dan's art, I would encourage you to run to his website. Dan, any final thoughts to the listeners as to maybe your experiential, you know, career as a firefighter, or your clinician career? Any words of wisdom or advice as to how to live a long, healthy life, maybe using your art or just generically in your experience?
Yeah, that's a big question. I hope when people look at the artwork, they realize that they're not alone. Your podcast, mm-hmm. No One Fights Alone, that they recognize that more than likely if they're having traumatic symptoms, it's a normal response to what we experience, right? And it's okay to have those feelings, but to get the help that you need to recover, because my big thing is post-traumatic growth. Although my foundation has resiliency in it, and a lot of the workshops I have resiliency, the word, but I'm not a big fan of resiliency, right? Because I think resiliency kind of limits our potential. Whereas growth is, if we have these traumatic experiences that we have as first responders, if we do the work and build new neural pathways, the potential, and this happens so often, I do my own conference every year about post-traumatic growth, where you can become better because of the traumatic experiences that you have, which is this whole concept of having hope versus resiliency. This is my own opinion, where, okay, my goal is just to get back to where I was. I'm struggling to get back to where I was versus, well, hey, you kind of got smashed back a little bit, but let's do the work. Be authentic to whatever your therapy is. And by building new neural pathways, you're going to become different. You're going to be better. You're going to be better because of the traumatic experiences you have. You're living proof of that. I'm living proof of that. So many of us have become better because of the traumatic experiences that we've had, because we've done the work and built those new neural pathways. And I'm not going to say it's an opportunity, because, you know, the fact of experiencing those traumatic symptoms are horrible and lethal in many cases, but there is hope there to go well beyond resiliency into the growth phase. And to don't do it alone. Find a therapist that has experience working with first responders, who has experience with trauma work, and they can help you do that.
Such great wisdom. And I'm going to apologize right off the bat, because I had this as a bullet to actually talk about, and I got so excited and got distracted. Your foundation, your charitable organization. Let me offer up an opportunity for you to give that a shout out as well. The Recovery and Resiliency Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the Recovery and Resiliency Foundation, we do three things. One, we help people. We're a Canadian foundation. Mm-hmm. So we help people navigate the traumatic symptoms that they have. We help them get help. Because in many cases, myself included, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know where to go. I didn't know who to call. I didn't know to utilize my employment assistance program. And then when I got the forms, I couldn't make sense of the forms. So we help people either utilize their benefits or help them get the help that they need. And we will set them up with a therapist And we double it up with some type of somatic work. So if you're talk therapy and equine therapy, or talk therapy and woodworking, or talk therapy and yoga. So try to combine, and it's a cellugenic approach versus just the talk therapy. So that's the one thing we do. The second thing we do is as long as we can afford it, we pay for the therapy for people. So we'll cover their or it's like $20 for them to see a therapist, and we'll help them through that. And then, because a lot of people don't have, if you think of part-time firefighters who maybe not have the benefits, don't have any benefits, and therapists are pricey, they're pretty expensive. Sure. So if you don't have the benefits to cover that, then you know that get pretty pricey. And then the third thing we do is that we do educational things. So we do a conference every year. Our next conference, which I haven't even promoted yet, I'm just confirming the lineup for our speakers, and it's going to be a gooder. It's going to be great. It's going to be this October 26th, 27th in Canmore, Alberta, right in the beautiful Rocky Mountains at the Malcolm Hotel. This will be the fourth conference that we put on, where I have people come and they talk about post-traumatic growth and recovery, and our foundation sponsors that.
I love that. That is amazing. Canadian charitable organization. I know we have a few listeners up there, so if you're listening, look them up.
And we have a lot of dollar connections in the United States as well. So if people feel they want to utilize, we can set them in the right pathway as well.
Right. Well, Dan, how does anybody find you? I know I've already given a shout out to your website, but you have any social media things that you want to?
Yes. Yeah, I got lots. So I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Threads. I'm trying the new, what all the kids are doing, Threads. So I'm on there too. And it's, all my handle names are all just Dance On or Dance On Photos. Mm-hmm.
Well, Dan, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the No One Fights Alone podcast. Thank you so much. This has been a real delight to have you on. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Brad. This is great. I can't believe it's been an hour already. I think we can talk about this for a long time. I really appreciate you having me on your show.
No, this is great. This is great. Thank you so much.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.